Hello and good afternoon. Welcome everybody to Out Front, the show where we talk about intelligence, security, preparedness, creating a first world zone in a third world country, and how to win at low intensity conflict, or at least not lose. I'm your host, Mike Shelby. I spent this weekend teaching a private course up in Oklahoma. It was actually a very nice drive. The part of Oklahoma I drove through, southern Oklahoma, is actually very pretty. I liked driving through the rolling hills. It was cool. Plus, it was not as hot as it has been in Texas. So it was a tiny little bit. Actually, I woke up Monday morning. I think it was Monday morning. It was 70 degrees outside. Like I wanted a jacket after that. So I had plenty of time to think. Plenty of time. The guy that's coming on the team up at Gray Zone, I'll introduce you to him, but I drove up part of the way with him, and we had a lot of time to talk about Gray Zone activity and the future of what we're doing, especially on the training side. I also had the opportunity to listen to Peter Zeihan's latest book, which is called The End of the World is Just the Beginning. And my takeaway from that book so far is if half the stuff he says is true, then the next 20 years are going to be incredibly painful, not just for Americans, but for the entire world. We're talking about never in my lifetime. I don't know how long maybe it has been since World War II that we will see the amount of political, social, and economic upheaval, the amount of just abject devastation that it probably has not been since World War II, if this indeed ends up happening. And a couple of things that really, basically the world is about to experience a demographic collapse. It's probably already happening, but it will continue to happen over the next 10 to 20 years. I'm going to type this in the chat for everyone. The guy's name is Peter Zeihan, or Zeihan, and the book is The End of the World is Just the Beginning. It's been a very good book so far. And I gave my synopsis so far in this morning's early warning report over at Ford Observer. By the way, we are running. I've been talking about this Independence Day, 4th of July sale. We're going to start it in earnest tomorrow morning, and it's going to go through Tuesday of next week, so until the 5th. If you sign up for a year of Ford Observer, you're going to get a year of the Gray Zone Study Group absolutely free. This weekend, we'll be creating those accounts. And so if you are a monthly subscriber, all you have to do is go into your My Account panel and upgrade to an annual. You'll get at a prorated rate. If you are a new subscriber, just sign up for a new subscription at forwardobserver.com/subscribe. And then if you are an annual subscriber, we're going to have the link to sign up because there's a special link. There's no easy way to do this, and it's really pissing me off. There's no easy way to do this, but we'll have a link for you, a different link, so where you can extend your annual subscription by an additional 12 months and then get Gray Zone Study Group for free for a year. Yes, and it is $99 a year. All right, that's going to be in tomorrow's report. We'll make sure everyone knows about it and gets the link. All right. By the way, when you go to the website, use the coupon code GRAYZONE. If you're listening, if you're getting this from this podcast, GRAYZONE, one word, gray with an A, GRAYZONE. And make sure everyone gets hooked up. Because the guy I just hired at GRAYZONE is going to help me run the GRAYZONE study group. By the way, he's a former infantry guy, but he was a sniper, and he went with me this past weekend. And he's actually also going to be helping me build these custom area studies. That's kind of the new thing too. I'd started doing that like a year or two ago, and I just didn't have the time. But now with him doing it and then me being able to jump on, we're also going to be doing custom area studies. And also after my next two open enrollment classes, I'll be in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania in July, here in just a couple weeks. And then I will be in Las Vegas, Nevada in August, teaching the tactical intelligence courses And after I teach those two courses, I may start doing these only private courses. So if you have a preparedness group, a preparedness network, a neighborhood watch, or you're just a group of friends who want to spend a day with me building out your area study. So I'll come in and we'll build you a custom area study with the group. And then we'll do that on the first day. The second day, we'll look at your intelligence requirements. We'll look at your, we'll build you a local intelligence gathering capacity, help you set up your network. And I'll give you a launch pad on a bunch of stuff you're going to be able to do on your own after that. But it'll be a 2-day class and incredibly useful for you. If you're interested in that, go ahead and send me a message either on Patreon or go to www.grayzoneactivity.com. And there's an email address on there, or just jump on the Ford Observer website and shoot me a message if you're interested in either doing a custom area study or a custom 2-day. All right. With that, let's talk about why I think 99% of the prepper community, even though I really dislike that term, I consider myself one. I dislike the term, but I'm highly into preparedness. But I'm going to tell you on today's show why probably 98 or 99% of them are full of crap when it comes to preparedness. And I don't want to, I may be stepping on some people's toes here, but the vast majority who believe they are prepared are absolutely not prepared. And I came to this conclusion while reading through Peter Zeihan's book, because I think what a lot of people are prepared for, and I've been teaching these classes and meeting with preparedness groups since like 2014. So I've experienced a lot of people. And what I found is that everyone focuses on sustainment. They focus on self-defense first, followed by food, and then maybe followed by water. And the ironic thing is water needs to be at or near the top, maybe right behind self-defense. Should probably go like water or self-defense and then food. And that's just the sustainment, right? People want to go out and buy all this whiz-bang stuff and a new lens added compass and a fire starter. And they have $200 worth of fire starting material and 0 seconds worth of an area study. And they really are putting the cart before the horse. They're effing up in technical parlance. Dustin, can you please hit me with the layer 1 and 2 solutions? There we go. Let me bring this up on my computer as well. All right. If you want to stop effing up, here's how you do that. Down here at the bottom, I've got layer 1 solutions, right? This is sustainment. This is the most, when people think about preparedness, this is what they are thinking about. Water storage and food. Listen, and I've got all this stuff too. It's super important. I'm not poo-pooing it. I'm just saying this is only the first step. There's a lot more stuff you got to do. So down at the bottom, we got layer 1 solutions. So food and water storage, maybe having a garden or, you know, digging a pond, having a shelter. Obviously, you've got to have that. Fire and survival, bug out bag, ouch pouch and IFAC, some kind of tactical medical kit, trauma kit, some means of self-defense. For most people, it's going to be firearms. And that's another thing. All right, if you're buying firearms because you can't afford them and, you know, whatever, you're trying to put your money in that, that's fine. I completely get that. But for the dudes that have like 10 AR-15s and 0 area studies, you're effing up. So, you know, unless you've got 9 other dudes you're going to outfit, I question the wisdom in having 10 ARs and, I don't know, not having other things beyond that layer 1 sustainment. Also, the dudes who have 10 AR-15s and a total of 0 hours training at a serious professional firearms training facility or under a firearms trainer, a serious one, you're also effing up. And then there's the ubiquitous Baofeng, which is fine. I bought 10 Baofengs when Amazon had some big 10 Baofeng package, and I bought them because I said, well, at a minimum, I'll be able to hand this out to my neighbors if something catastrophic does happen, and we'll be able to maintain communications. I'm not knocking Baofeng. I'm just saying, my own crew, we don't run Baofengs. We run a much better radio. And then there's ham radio, which I think is also very important. I'm just like always studying for my ham test. And I can tell you the difference between an ohm and a gigawatt, but I'm working at it. Those are layer 1 solutions. That's stuff that's going to keep you alive into tomorrow. But eventually, not much longer. Now, after that, you should be graduating into layer two solutions, and that should be your focus. I'm still putting away food. I just vacuum sealed another 50 pounds of rice and, or 50 pounds of beans and 75 pounds of rice the other day, like a week or two ago, because I'm concerned about food availability in the future. However, I have not done that at the cost of the following things. Number one, by the way, if you want this graphic, yeah, you can just screenshot in your computer, whatever. But I've got this graphic here, basic, intermediate, and advanced, layer one and layer two solutions. Go ahead and go over to the dispatch, www.grayzoneactivity.com/dispatch. And I will be emailing this image out probably at the end of the week. I'll type it in here for everybody. That's my email list. There's like 13,000 people on there. You're in good company. I'll be emailing that out at the end of the week. I'll give you, if you're listening to the podcast, you got a couple days. So let's go through these layer two solutions here. Number one, establish, and by the way, this is in no particular order, but all this stuff I think is important. And all this stuff is not on the typical, you know, the prepper checklist. Oh, get your beans and rice and get your calorie and fat dense food and get your, okay, I'm not talking about any of that crap. All right, no particular order. Establish neighborhood watch. Every soldier is a sensor. That's what we said in the Army. In your community, every neighbor is a sensor. If you are not lining those sensors up, if you're not recruiting those sensors and giving them a way to contact you, you're effing up. So maybe hold off on buying that fourth year of food and recruit your neighbors, or start a neighborhood watch, or at least go to your neighbors and test the water. Stick your toes in the water over there in terms of preparedness. If they're concerned, say, hey, let's start a neighborhood watch. It would not hurt anything for us to be looking out for each other, looking for suspicious activity or suspicious vehicles or suspicious individuals in the neighborhood or in the community. And you know what? We might even prevent a crime, or maybe even help catch a bad guy if we do that. By the way, one of the problems they're having in Oklahoma, same problem we're having here in Texas, which is cattle theft. And the group out there brought a really good point. Also hay theft. So any kind of organized or disorganized theft, any potential victim who understands the risk is probably going to have some level of motivation to cooperate. So find these people in your community. They're not going to self-organize. You have to organize them. And once you do that, once you establish a neighborhood watch, you know what you have? You have a de facto intelligence network. You have an information sharing network in your community. One thing we have is we're all on Signal Chat. And so all the guys in our network, we share information on Signal. There's stuff popping off there every single day, either in the news or more local. Also, one guy who's, I think, a critical component, a lot of the times he'll put discount codes in there for stuff that people probably need to buy. I need to buy, like a water filter, especially. And so he's very good about doing that. But it's not just that. It's local land for sale. I can't tell you how many times I've heard of people buying a home or buying land before it even got listed on the market, just because of the network. Stuff, you know, people are selling farm equipment and implements and all sorts of stuff. And before that even gets put on Facebook or Craigslist or whatever, it's bought, because we have a guy that says, oh, hey, this guy's selling this. And it's like, yeah, actually, we really need that. So there are many benefits to having a local information sharing network. Again, in no particular order, building an area study. It's super important. There are six layers of your area study, and there are four threat types. If you don't understand what those are, that should probably be number one on your list. Because when you do an area study, you are looking at, you're identifying the things that you need to prepare for. You're going to find what's going to break. And when you start to consider second and third and fourth order effects of those things, especially the threats, you're going to say, hey, this is a massive risk. We are not prepared for this. And now we have to start implementing some risk mitigating procedures. We got to find some ways to mitigate this risk. There was a student of mine many years ago, and he lived in South Carolina, and he moved. He did his area study. He said, I do not like what I see. I do not like what I have around me. And he was a firefighter, so he's fairly mobile. He can get a job in a lot of different places. And he had kids. And he said, look, in a catastrophe, I do not want my kids living around here because there's all sorts of problems there. And so he started looking at a couple of other properties elsewhere in the state. He did an area study and assessment for them that he learned in the class that I taught. And he found an area that he really liked after he did this area study. There's so many people, they'll go out and buy a house and they may be surrounded by some very shitty people, some very bad hombres. And unless you do your area study, you are not going to know that. It's just like all these people. They're like, oh, I'm moving from New York, or I'm moving from California, or moving from North Carolina, or whatever. And I'm going up in the hills in Idaho, or I'm going up to Montana. And they don't know a soul. And there are these people who are buying these half million, multi-million dollar retreat properties up there in the Pacific Northwest, up in the mountains. And without doing an area study, without knowing who they are surrounded by and what they're surrounded by, they may have a very difficult, they may find life is very difficult up there, in addition to, you know, not just being used to dealing with the snow. By the way, a couple people in here. So some guy says, Baofengs are fine. You can buy more expensive handhelds, but they're not that much better. Yeah, listen, in a pinch, for, you know, whatever, $40 or whatever they cost, Baofengs are fine in a pinch. There are some things that I dislike about Baofengs. Number one, they're not weatherproof. The case around a Baofeng is not meant to be wet. Can you get a Baofeng wet and still have it operate? Yeah, maybe. I've heard people say, I dropped my Baofeng going down the road and I went back and picked it up and it still worked. Hey man, if that's you, consider yourself lucky. There absolutely are some very good upgrades from a Baofeng. And the Yaesu, one of the radios that I really like is the Yaesu FT-70. I mean, it's FD-70. Yaesu F-70 something. A little more expensive radio. But magnitudes better, orders of magnitude better than a Baofeng. All right. You're not going to find, okay, what's up, Josh? Josh says you're not going to find any security in civilian radios. Again, my brother in Christ, I don't believe this is true. Now, security always comes back to what individual, what entity or organization is trying to collect information from you. And there absolutely is some security in civilian radios. The Motorola, they don't make them anymore, but the DTR 550, they don't make anymore, but they do make the 700 and the 750. They have frequency hopping, and you're not going to hide from the NSA. But my local Bubba Finder, my basic off-the-shelf SIGINT equipment, I'm not going to be able to listen into your radio communications. So you actually can get, and that's one reason why I run those 700s. Again, I'm not worried about, you know, hiding from the NSA or, you know, whatever. But I am maybe concerned about, or potentially concerned about, in a catastrophe or some big emergency, I am maybe concerned about coming up on a scanner or some other person out there who's scanning for, I don't know, maybe people who have things, maybe people talking about, you know, their garden or their livestock or whatever. And if I can be off that radar, so much the better. That's why that's a really good intra-team radio. Now, I'm not talking to the other end of the county on a Motorola DTR 700, but from one end of my property to the other, absolutely. And that is but that's an intra-team radio. I'm not trying to establish area communications on that thing. So I don't want to get in the weeds of the radios. There are some things I've identified that give me a strategic advantage, i.e. being off the radar of Bubba Finders. I got a radio that it'll just, you know, I talk about it in class, but it'll go and look for other communications in the vicinity or in the area. So hang on 1 second. Sorry, my dog's having like a little doggy dream and he's starting to growl and bark in his sleep. All right. So after the radio stuff, and I'm sure the comments are going absolutely nuts, but that's my take. If you're watching this, I hope you're watching this because you understand that I spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I'm looking at different gear. I'm constantly buying new gear and testing it out and figuring out what's going to work best for me. And sometimes I'll share that information with you. So if it's helpful for you, great. All right. The next thing after buying, next thing after building your area study is establishing a community S2 or building an ACE, analysis and control element. That is, the community S2 is your intel shop. So maybe it's one or two people, maybe it's a handful of people who during an emergency can get together and say, okay, great. Here's the power's off. How are we going to get information? How are we going to figure out what's going on out there? Well, you got your map and acetate, you sit down with your markers, you're gathering information from members of the community, from members of your preparedness network, maybe open source if it's available. We're listening to the police scanner. We're listening to our SIGINT equipment, signals intelligence, listening into, you know, radio communications. And we're just monitoring all that stuff until we find something of intelligence value, something that can help us piece together what our local security situation looks like. We're going to throw that on the map. And after a while, we're going to build out what our security picture looks like. And we are going to be kept apprised of developments or individuals who could pose a threat to us and hopefully have some early warning there. So, okay, there's a thing in here about encryption, which is at some levels illegal per FCC rules. There are ways you can legally encrypt your radio, and they involve, and again, I'm not an expert because I'm not a super ham guy, but I know dudes who run encryption on their radios on VHF, UHF. You can do, I think you actually have to have like a specific license, but yeah, you absolutely can encrypt some radios. There are absolutely ways to do it legally. All right. By the way, encryption is kind of it's a PITA, it's a PITA, a pain in the rear end, because a radio loses encryption fill or somebody presses the wrong button. Okay, great. And that now that guy, not only can he not listen, he cannot communicate encrypted. So I'm not saying not to seek out ways to encrypt your local radio. But listen, again, all this comes back to who's after you. Now, there's a thing in here. People can direction find you. That is true. That's another thing I generally dislike about Balfangs is I can absolutely direction find you. If you have a frequency hopping radio, it's a lot. I'm not actually sure unless you have something very sophisticated with that frequency hopping around in fractions of a second. If you're trying to DF a specific frequency and that frequency, that transmission is only on that frequency for a split second. I don't know that you're going to be able to DF that. So I think that's another security feature of having frequency hopping radios, which absolutely are, absolutely is a strategic advantage. All right. There are a lot of ComSec things, and actually I got like half a day on communication security. So there's a ton of stuff you can do. All right. Let's go ahead and move on here to the next thing. After you've established a neighborhood watch and you're building your local intelligence network, you've done your area study, and you have established, even just in theory, you've established a team of people to help, you know, battle track what's going on, to help run all this intelligence activity. The next thing you need to do is identify existing and future supply lines. The big epiphany from reading Peter Zeihan's book is everything is about to break. Everything is already in the process of breaking. You know, he talks about piracy, how piracy in the future is going to be a very big problem. And how, you know, you have a container ship and it's got 1,000 widgets for a Honda Civic, and that that container ship, and not, it's not just 1,000 parts for that Honda Civic, it's got tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of somethings on that ship. And then and if that's taken and these pirates try to sell that stuff on the black market, that is 1,000 Honda Civics not being made. And this is the inherent vulnerability of globalization, is everything is so specialized. And not only is everything so specialized, things are made in all different parts of the world. You know, you have a handful or dozen or maybe dozens of countries, at least dozens of manufacturing facilities involved in making one thing, whether that's a TV or a car or a tractor or whatever. And so with all of these, with global supply lines breaking down, with the end of globalization and the beginning of deglobalization, I don't think the average American appreciates just how expensive things are going to get. Peter, in this, it's a great book. He talks about since the 1980s with globalization, things have gotten cheaper, better, and faster. And that's ending, which means things are going to get more expensive. They're probably not going to be as good as what we have now. And it's going to take a lot longer, especially as more of these countries reshore a lot of their supply chains. Because when the United States stops protecting global commerce, that is the absolute end of globalization. There is not a single country besides the United States, there's not a single country on earth that has benefited more from U.S. protecting global trade than China. Because China does not have a navy to protect its global trade. It is wholly dependent on U.S. naval presence all around the world to keep these pirates at bay, to keep, you know, hijackings and all the other things from happening. And as soon as the United States says, well, we can't afford it anymore, or as soon as the United States says, well, we're gonna reshore so much stuff back to the Western Hemisphere that we will not need to have a global presence. And I'm not sure that I 100% agree with Peter Zeihan that this will happen, but he's absolutely right. If it does happen, this absolutely is the end of globalization. And if you're a country that is heavily dependent on imports, you are screwed. Life is going to become very, very difficult for you if this does happen. If you're, you know, all these expats, they say, oh, I'm going to go live down in, you know, X or Y country because it's cheap. And if that place is dependent on food imports, like islands especially, if that place cannot import oil and gas, if it cannot import food, if it cannot import all the raw materials or whatever it needs to sustain it, life ain't going to be so grand there anymore. So at any rate, identify existing and future supply chains. Figure out what you need, what you really need. And I'm not talking about on your trips to Target or your trips to Sam's Club. Find out what you really need on a day-to-day basis and figure out what your life is going to be like once that stops, because it may well be stopping. And then let's figure out how we can come together and build a new supply line or make something that make a replacement for that much closer to home. By far, my biggest takeaway from this, and I actually just texted somebody the other day about this, my biggest takeaway from this book so far is that we are way too focused on sustainment, and we are not as focused on building local security beyond your line of sight, and most importantly, economic opportunity. We have to be building political, social, and economic power. And part of economic power, actually, let me just look this text up, because I said it and I was like, man, I need to say that on the show. In light of Zeihan, we as a community are vastly underestimating the need to develop economic resilience, provide jobs and stability, and localize new industries. Guys, if you are not doing that, you are not going to be prepared for what's coming. Yeah, you'll be prepared for a tornado and you'll be able to, you know, be prepared because you got your little food and water and Baofengs. But guys, we got to start figuring out how we can build local economic resilience. Joblessness is a universal early warning indicator of civil unrest, especially joblessness for young people. And if we do, part of the thing that So Zeon's main argument is that the world is experiencing a demographic collapse because there simply are not enough young people. Birth rates in the United States, or fertility rates in the United States, is 1.6. Fertility rate in China is 1.7. We are not replacing ourselves. And China has a massive inversion of its demographics. There are far more old people than there are young people. And that means those old people, they're going to age out of the workforce. They're in a lot of these countries, especially European countries, they're going to stop paying taxes. And so these governments are going to have large budget deficits. They're going to take their money out of equities and put it into bonds or whatever else they're going to put it into. And so you're going to have much lower returns in the future in stock markets. And we have lived like there at no point on earth has life been better, maybe with the exception of the Garden of Eden. At no point in history has life been better than it has from the 1980s until 2019. And it only gets worse from here. And maybe at some point it'll get better again. But probably for the next 20 years, it's going to get worse. And so the question is, if we do have very bad stagflation, high inflation, if food prices don't come down, which they may not, because a lot of that is based on supply, not just demand. The bottom line here is that if what Zeon says is true, and I have no reason to doubt him, if the world is going to experience a demographics collapse, then everything about our world changes. And Zeon talks about looking at globalization. Globalization has basically turned the world into a small town where we trade, we're able to specialize because, you know, this guy's the blacksmith and this guy's the plumber and this guy's the electrician and everyone's so specialized. And as we have globalization, that's fine. The problem is, once globalization ends, we no longer live in a small town, and all that specialization has to get turned back into generalization. And so actually, without globalism, specialization actually hurts us. It's actually not an advantage. It's a massive disadvantage. All right, here's what we're going to do. I still have a bunch of stuff to talk about on Layer 2 Solutions. I'll end up with this. Economic development, figuring out how you're going to employ people, whether that's in a garden or repairing things. Here's the other thing. I got a buddy. He's a mechanic. His mechanic shop is about to go out of business because they cannot get the spare parts. And if they don't have the spare parts, they ain't fixing vehicles. If they ain't fixing vehicles, they ain't making money. So if this truly is the end of globalization and we're only on the front edge of it, it is going to get much, much worse, because how long is it going to take for us to build factories that can build spare parts for all the stuff that we have? It's going to take, not only is it a problem of time, it's also a matter of money, of capital expenditure. And so, you know, I read that book and I just thought, man, everyone's so focused on sustainment. We got to figure out how we can go back to the village where, you know, instead of having, you know, Wang Chang making our stuff in a factory over there, you know, it's Tom down the road. He's a blacksmith. He's got a metal fabrication shop. He's doing whatever. And he's going to make the spare parts that we need because we're not getting it from China anymore. Or maybe they'll bring all that stuff back to Mexico. And, you know, I think we'd be in a much better position if we could rebase a lot of our manufacturing, if not in the United States, then in near shore down to Mexico. All right. So I'll take a couple questions here. Dustin, if you can help me figure out some of these questions. There's one. What do you think about the mapping companion to Peter Zeon's book? Listen, I have been listening to the audiobook. I still have to go back now that I'm back, not on the road. I'll be cracking that book open because I want to reread a couple parts and look at a couple chapters. So I actually have not seen the mapping companion, but I'll take a look at it. If the U.S. reshores our factories, won't that be good for the lower middle class Americans in the long run? Yeah, if we bring manufacturing back to the United States, yeah, because it will not only be good for the lower and middle class, it'll also be good for the country. Because we will have something to sustain the middle class. And the middle class is what built this country. And offshoring and all that stuff, that has helped predominantly has helped the elites, because they're the owner of these corporations, and it's great for shareholders. You run higher profits, you maximize profits for shareholders. And it's great. It hurts the middle class. It absolutely hurts the middle class. And I understand they may have money in the markets and invested in some of these companies, but you know what the middle class guy needs? He's got to have a job. He's got to have a good paying job with benefits for his family. All right, Dustin, any other questions out there? Chris says, Mike, just a heads up, I'm a truck driver. I've been coming across truck stops that are out of DEF, diesel exhaust fluid, and have pumps down due to part shortages. Chris, thanks for the information. We've been talking about that at Ford Observer since South Korea started having diesel exhaust fluid DEF or DEF shortages. And that was 3-6 months ago. So thanks for the information. It's another data point. Listen, we're not out of this. And this also, a lot of the things I talked about is kind of a best case scenario. Because if this NATO-Ukraine-Russia conflict widens to include other countries, or if we do get into some military confrontation with China, because China says, look, global NATO is expanding, the Quad is getting their stuff together, we are running, maybe, I'm not saying this is the case, but I'm just saying there could be conditions that are developing that would actually encourage China to make a military move on Taiwan, or to use some kind of force to retake Taiwan because their window of opportunity is closing. You know, that a war with China everything stops, man. Everything stops. And all the supply lines that we have that are filled by China, we're going to have to figure out a way to rebuild that domestically. And I'm just saying it would behoove you to start thinking about this, how you can rebuild something like that domestically. When the small town of globalization stops, how are you going to build the small town of, you know, how are you going to reshore all that specialization to somewhere near you so that you can get all that stuff? So, man, way too much time and energy invested in sustainment, not enough in second layer solutions. I'm going to finish the talk on second layer solutions because I got a bunch of other stuff to talk about. We'll do that on tomorrow's show. There's a couple of questions in here. Dustin, let's do lightning around on these questions. If you can help me find them, please. Mike, do you think general American public will be more right wing or left wing than it is today in 10 years? And where do you see our country by then? Yeah, that's a good question. I would say culturally it could be more right wing. I think Americans are revolting against a lot of the things we see in pop culture today. I think Americans are revolted by it by and large. Like the average, you know, moderate American. Economically, we could become far more left-wing, because if we do have a Great Depression, we have hyperinflation potentially, we have just stagflation. I think there's a solid case to be made that universal basic income becomes a lot more popular as a concept. And with the greater need, I don't think the average American is going to say, well, I just need to pull myself up by my bootstraps. I need to go out and find a better job. Where are the jobs? If it's a Great Depression, there's going to be no jobs. So I could see them becoming culturally, socially more conservative and economically more liberal, or more favoring forget a social safety net. They want a social safety hammock. That's one way I could see it happening in the next 10 years. All right, next question. So training will now just be on a consulting basis. Any additional online training options? Yeah, so here's the deal. I'll probably still teach the one-off course here and there, open enrollment, if there's like a large enough demand. But what I really want to do is go in and be more of a consultant and help preparedness groups build this stuff over the course of 2 days and then give them a list of things that they need to build after I leave. And part of that will be, we are going to put, one reason why I'm bringing Sam on is we're going to put a lot more training and stuff online. So yes, there absolutely will be. Actually, most of my Tech Intel class will be online at some point, probably this year. I've just got to get enough time to go in there and record the modules and do all that stuff and put it, package it up in an online version. By the way, all of our training, the Area Intelligence course is up right now. I think it's, you know, good as is. People like it. It's been helpful. But we're going to be re-recording the Area Intelligence course. By the way, you can get that at www.grayzoneactivity.com. And I think it's under training or courses or something like that. Next question. If there is one. If the Mexican cartel is in possession of a majority of the factories, then encouragement to reopen should be a priority. Yeah. I've thought of that. You know, they say the cartels run the avocado industry or, you know, whatever. There's a good chance that cartels get involved and maybe they own, what are they called? The maquiladoras or whatever on the border of Mexico. Listen, Mexico used to make a bunch of stuff for the United States. And then China came around and the bottom fell out of Mexico in the 90s. So, I don't know how to solve that problem. I don't know how to keep the cartels out of manufacturing if we do rebase our manufacturing to Mexico. And also, I'm just not an expert in that, so I'm probably not best suited to solve it. But yeah, that's a concern. All right, next question. I got downvoted on Reddit for telling someone their carry pistol should look black or metallic, not full green, because normies might think it's a toy. Am I right or wrong? Maybe. I wouldn't paint a pistol green. There are advantages to not having a green pistol. Next question. I think you're right, brother. Is Operation Sandman a real plan? Never heard of it. 100 nations vowing to drop petrodollar at once overnight. No. Operation Sandman. I don't know. Doubt it. It doesn't even sound real, but 100 nations at night vowing to drop the dollar. Who are they going to sell to? You cannot do this overnight. You cannot dump dollars overnight. Unless you can sell it. Here's the problem, right? If we're a town of 50 people and I have 1,000 mangoes to sell off and I start selling one a day, okay, it'll take me 1,000 days to sell them off. If I try to sell all 1,000 tomorrow, not only is everyone going to buy up, they're going to buy up all the mangoes they need, and then mangoes will just be free because nobody's going to buy them. So nobody's going to get stuck holding that bag. The biggest indicator is, you know, we can track, there are two indicators I'd be looking for the demise of the dollar. And actually we know what this looks like already. It's a trajectory, but it's not imminent. U.S. dollars as a share of global reserve of, U.S. dollars as a share of foreign held reserves. That was back, it was in the 70s, like the 70 something percent, 75% in the 1990s, mid 90s. And then that has dropped down to 50 or 61% in 2019 and 59%. So it's dropped from 77 to 59. Okay. That's what you call a trend, but you know, it's not going to zero tomorrow, which is what you're talking about. The other thing is the amount of exchange trades that are settled in US dollars. Right now, something like 85, maybe 88% of foreign exchange trades are settled in dollars. That is market dominance. The dollar is going to die eventually. There's a very good case for the dollar actually getting a lot stronger from here. And when people talk about a strong dollar, they're measuring it against foreign currencies because those foreign currencies are trash. Absolute trash. That's why the dollar is going to strengthen versus them, but it's going to probably continue to weaken versus real physical assets, especially, you know, food and, you know, oil and whatever else. Next question. If we're depopulating, can mass immigration be a good thing for the U.S.? Well, that's the whole argument. I mean, that was Angela Merkel's argument for Germany. They said, she said, look, our fertility rates are too low. Our tax base is shrinking. We have a socialist economy. You cannot have your tax base shrink when you're trying to take care of older people, which is exactly what happened, what's happening in Germany. So they turned on the floodgates. And then she turned around and said, yeah, actually multiculturalism, that was a mistake. It really doesn't work. And in the United States, I firmly believe that maybe in addition to the political and cultural benefit of having mass immigration from Latin America come to the United States, in addition to that, there's also the tax benefit. You expand the tax base, you increase consumer demand. There's people that have to go out and buy stuff, and that creates economic activity. So I think, you know, I think part of that is, you know, is, will mass immigration benefit the United States? Purely economically, yes, but the United States is not just an economy. It used to be a real place. So yeah, maybe it's only economy. An economy anymore, but yeah, mass immigration will help the United States strategically compete against China and other countries. Internally, you know, what happens when you erode the culture that built this country? I don't see anything good happening. So yeah, maybe the United States will remain the largest economy in the world, you know, or the most advanced economy in the world, but at what cultural cost? Next question. If this isn't the last question, I'll do two more. Peter Zeon is bullish on the United States. You seem bearish with the demise of the American empire. Has his book made you rethink any of your assumptions? So I'm only halfway through the book. So far, he has not addressed low-intensity conflict. I think maybe he mentions maybe the possibility of like a civil war, some kind of domestic conflict. And also, he mentions the potential for an America 2.0, you know, what comes after? What does America look like in the new world? The end of the world is happening, but the end of this world is just the beginning of the next world. I'm bullish on the United States because I think we will go through a period of low intensity conflict. I think the only thing that's made me, there's two things that have made me rethink my thesis. And that is that maybe this is just the end of the American Republic, which I've talked about. And maybe the American Empire in earnest has not even started. Number one. And number two, historically, the dollar is set to lose its world reserve status probably in the next 20 to 40 years. Will the digital dollar change that? I don't know, but that's one thing that, listen, the American fiscal shape is too bad. There's $30 trillion in national debt. There's another, some people say it's like $170 trillion in unfunded liabilities. I've seen other people say upwards of $200 trillion in unfunded liabilities, things that the government's on the hook for, but can't afford. And so the government's going to be forced to do three things. Number one, they're going to have to print money. You can't tax that amount of money, but they're going to try. Number two, you got to raise taxes. Number three, you got to cut benefits. And history is very clear that whenever a country is forced to print money to fund the government, it's typically when you have hyperinflation. That is the underlying cause. It's typically not the trigger, but there will be, I think there's very likely to be a trigger there. So the America as we know it today, I think is ending. I don't know what it's going to look like in another 20 years, but where we are right now is unsustainable. I don't think it can continue. Next question. And this will be the last one if there is one. How do you see the loss of power from the Hoover Dam affecting the Southwest and migrant flow? Well, yeah, if there's no water, I guess migrants are going to go somewhere else. But really, the Southwest is electrical production. And though, I mean, Lake Mead and Lake Powell are something like 29% or something of where they should be. So with this drought historically lasting years, We listen, if those cities, if they run out of water, people are just going to move. They're going to go somewhere else that has less water. And actually, I have heard someone mentioned this the other day. It's kind of a theory, but they think if the drought, if this drought has over the past 3,000 years, this drought that the West is experiencing right now, the West Coast, it's not just the West Coast. I mean, it's half part of the United States, the West half. Historically, over the past 3,000 years, this has been a 20 to 30 year drought. And I think California has been dealing with bad drought for about 10 years now. And so if it does last 20 to 30 years and it worsens, then one theory is that a bunch of people who currently live in the West in the middle of a desert are going to be moving towards the East. And so another interesting thing that Peter Zeihan talks about is the coming deurbanization. When those jobs go away from these urban areas, people aren't going to stay there. If there's no jobs, they're going to go back to the rural areas and start farms and, you know, go back to some, I don't necessarily know they'll go back to an agrarian lifestyle, but they ain't going to stay in the cities if there's no jobs there. And at the point you can have a home on 1 acre, you can grow enough food to be a subsistence farmer, basically. So at any rate, all right, way over time today. I'm going to be back tomorrow, 2 p.m. Central Time, and we're going to talk about the rest of these layer two solutions, the stuff that you need to be building locally once you get out of this sustainment mindset. Would I rather have a local intelligence network up and functioning, running at 100% or 7 years worth of food? I'd rather have the local intelligence network. We can find food, and we may be able to find food real fast. If you don't have an intel network, that's not something you can build quick, fast, and in a hurry. I think it probably, I was talking to a buddy about this. I think we both think it probably takes about 18 months to build an intelligence network that's functioning to the level that you're going to need it to function. So when it comes to food or intel, give me intel every day of the week and twice on Sunday. All right, 2 p.m. back on the show tomorrow. Thank you for the support. By the way, if you want to support the show, you can do that at patreon.com/outfront. It's patreon.com/outfront. Kick me a few bucks a month or however much you think this show is worth to you. And until tomorrow, be well and stay out front.